Welcome back, folks. Good to have you here. I hope you had a good day. I'm Henrik from Sweden, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We are going to wrap up this week with a somewhat different show for you, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to go on the charge against the politically correct together with Mike Enoch and Seventh Son, who joins us from The Daily Showa, a weekly podcast by some of the folks over at The Right Stuff. Now, I've been enjoying some of their shows because it is something that goes against all of the imposed so-called wisdom of our times, all the sensitivity training and all the things that we shouldn't say or do. Plus, it's just so much fun making fun of liberals, their agenda, and their insane policies. But we'll get into some more serious topics as well. However, one thing I want to mention, this program was recorded before the Charleston church shooting and the attacks on the rebel or the Confederate flags that we've consequently seen after that. And if it wasn't, we would have been all over those topics as well. So now you know the reason why that is not going to be brought up in the program. Nonetheless, I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome, gentlemen. It's great to have you both here. We have with us here on the line Mike Enoch. Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. Thank you for coming on. And we also have Seventh Son with us. Say hi, Seventh Son.
Hey, how are you? Good to be on. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Well, it's good to have you here. As I said, it's I've been listening to your show for a little bit here in the last couple of weeks, really, more of going back in the archives and listening to a bunch of them in a row in the background, I guess, while working on some other stuff. And I found it hilarious and very refreshing because you're just so over and done with the liberals and progressive, and it's a lot of fun listening to that. And I can't say I agree with everything you guys talk about, but that doesn't matter. I think it's great to have you guys here, and it's always a pleasure to connect with folks who are fighting to break down that which is destroying Western civilization, and especially with humor in the way that you guys are doing. It's just very important and so refreshing. But maybe to kind of bring our audience up to speed a little bit, guys, we can just talk about, you know, when you started the show or the Showa and you know, the name and all that, and how that came about. And we can talk about, you know, you guys individually, how you kind of, you know, came to all of this, but who would ever want to pick up that ball, I guess.
You know, sure. Oh, do you want to go? You want to start? You can go ahead.
You did it on Sunday for the Renegade broadcasting, so maybe I'll do the summary.
Yeah, you go.
It's all right. The Right Stuff was basically, it was a Facebook group of friends. It's just it was an outgrowth of libertarian and kind of, what was it, the Muti Haters Club or something like that? Some kind of mutualism group?
Yeah, we had a group that was sort of guys that had been libertarians or various forms of anarcho-capitalists. I don't know if your audience is familiar with these terms, but I mean, I sort of assume that people in the right-wing politics in America know what these terms mean, whether or not they agree with them.
So I'll ask you to define them if we need to later.
Okay, all right. So we were sort of a bunch of guys getting kind of tired of that scene and getting really fed up with the progressive and liberal infiltration of it. And we're just looking at a bunch of other things, and including, you know, neo-reactionary stuff, radical traditionalism, white nationalism, things like that. Those were some of the areas that people were exploring. And so, you know, I just set up a blog for my friends, really, at first. And we did that for a couple years. We got a few thousand guys that were reading and commenting on our articles, and we thought we would just try doing a podcast for the hell of it, just to
it's the most crowdsourced, democratically run, fascist website. You'll anybody can just like everybody we know kind of has an account, and if they have an article, and as long as it's not god awful or formatted terribly, it'll go up.
Sometimes things go up, even if they are awful and formatted.
Yeah, sometimes things go up and they shouldn't have. That has happened. But it's been good. And yeah, so we just, one day there was, I don't know, were we laughing? No, because that was much later, the Brad Spangler affair. I don't know who we were laughing. But you just kind of wanted to, you had always said that you, I mean, I always enjoyed your writings probably the most on the site, and you'd always said you hated writing, Mike, and I thought that was like crazy that that you just you didn't enjoy the process. It took you too long. You would rather just talk. And so one day you just floated the idea in the group, what's podcast? And I being a struggling, you know, hobbyist of a musician for years and years, I have all this, you know, project studio equipment in the house. And I said, well, I mean, we'll log on Skype. I can record it. And I think I'm enough of a jerk to at least contribute some snappy wisecracks and produce some comedy for it. And we'll go from there. And it's been great. And a friend of ours, one of our writers, Duke Godwin, he said, you know, names were being tossed around. He said, how about the Daily Showa? And that was it. Because everything that just wrote itself, because you had the idea right there. You take the Daily logo and put you just alter it to say Showa instead of Show, and it's just the whole thing is there. And as long as the Daily Show stays relevant, I guess we could keep doing it.
That will be for quite a while, I think. Unfortunately,
yeah. And we just, you know, we kept going with that theme. I don't know if people know, but one of our segments, and whether or not we can say this word on your show, I don't know, it's the Shitlord Report.
Oh, sure, you can.
But we were running with it as like a gag on the Colbert Report. I always thought we called it like the Shitlord Report, but we never really did that. But so we ripped that logo for that one. I mean, for minute one, you know, the funny thing is both Seventh Son and I grew up in the New York area. So we were both, I mean, I think you were a fan of Opie and Anthony, right? Like in the 2000s?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we were both fans of Opie and Anthony, which is a kind of it was on mainstream radio, but it was kind of like an edgy comedy, talk comedy show. And so we kind of innately took cues from them, like sort of took some bits of their format. Like we do some of our comedy in the same way that they do. Now we're a little bit... They were fairly conservative for American politics, but they were still in the mainstream.
Right.
We're a little bit further out there in terms of our politics, but we kind of stole their format a little bit.
Yeah, I sometimes catch myself like lifting a joke from them every now and then. Go, oh, shit! I have to stop myself from.
Just blatantly lift jokes from them. I don't mind.
I try to stop myself, or I realize I'm doing it and I stop. It happened here. I think I said. Somebody called me out on it on the blog recently. I said Floyd a while ago, and that's direct. That's Dr. Steve, their medical expert. They talk.
Okay. You know, you probably listened more recently than I have. I haven't listened to them in a while. But
well, guys, maybe we can just speak a little bit about, I guess, how you kind of your own journey, whatever you feel like you want to share with that. I think. In recent years, more and more people have obviously started looking at these things and just getting sick and generally fed up with progressivism, wherever it leads us. The journey might be a little bit different in Europe than it is in America, I think. But nonetheless, it's we're seeing how things are changing around us. Seventh Son, why don't we begin with you and ask you just a little bit about, I guess, how you ended up talking about the kinds of things you're doing right now.
Oh, God. I grew up fairly for America, right wing, pretty small business family, but you know, in New York, so still kind of dildo-fied, as we said. I ended up just kind of like, I kind of dabbled in libertarianism for a bit. After 9/11, I started paying attention a lot more and was really pretty much blue-pilled pro-Israel, kind of average, you know, gung-ho Iraq, let's go in there and take out Saddam and change the regime and... We'll democratize all these mongrels and obviously that didn't work out too well. And with disillusionment from that, because I seriously suffered from Iraq fatigue in around like, you know, 06, 07 as the thing was still dragging on. And it was really like looking around like the other right wingers, like the other conservatives, like, guys, what the hell's going on here? Where's the end game? When's this big victory going to happen? And it never was. And that kind of pushed me over to Ron Paul, and that kind of blew up too, because as time wore on with the libertarian movement in a few years, that really got infused with liberalism and progressivism too. Like it seemed like I was having more nasty arguments of left versus right about social justice within libertarianism that I thought was going to be like safe space for me to hang out and not have to deal. Here was feminism like way harder than it ever was, like doing basic bitch politics, just regular left right. So I got out of that, and I thank God I through other things, stumbled onto the TRS, and I had actually been Facebook friends with Mike for a couple of years, but I had no idea this was his site. I had no idea that he was behind this.
This actually makes me feel better how, because we were Facebook friends probably from, there was a point at which when I first joined Facebook and I was making friends with like all libertarians that had like two mutual friends, and that's just randomly how we make friends.
Right.
You didn't know it was me, and that's good.
Yeah,
because I was using my real name for a while there.
You had to out yourself. You basically you started sharing links from the site too often to be like, all right, this guy involved? Because then I would see like Alex McNabb commenting on your statuses, and he used his actual name on the blog. I was like, all right, this isn't just some guy who likes this site. And I don't know, somehow my way into the group eventually, but that was pretty much the journey. And now here I am reading Kevin McDonald and losing my mind and realizing that it's worth thought and doing a podcast about it.
So. Well, there you go. Well, it's good. We need as many people as we can fighting all of this that's going on, obviously. And we'll get into some of these a little bit more detail later about many of the crazy things that's going on. But Mike, let's just talk about your road to where you are today. When did you start the website? Was that a couple of years ago or more?
I started the website actually in December of 2012. December 1st, 2012, actually, because I know that because whenever I want to collect all my stats on Google Analytics, I'll select back to December 1, 2012 and up till now. So we're coming up on 3 years. We started the show in August. Our first show was August 8th, 2014. So after about a year and a half, year and a half plus, give or take a few months, we decided to do this. And like I said, the site spawned out of this Facebook group of what I would just say were fed-up libertarians or post-libertarians. And there was not really any unified ideology at that time. Like I said, I was still very libertarian in my views when I started the site. I was still very pro, and I still am. I'm pro laissez-faire. I'm pro-free market. That's probably not going to change. Unless something drastic happens. But, so I was still like that. I had some guys that were going really very hard into the Christian area. Some guys were going really neo-reactionary. Some people were, people were experimenting with a whole new, because everybody was like, libertarianism is kind of done. Or it's done for us. We've gone as far as we can go with it. And I was big into it. I was a libertarian for like 10 years. I was reading Lou Rockwell. I was reading antiwar.com. I even had an essay that I wrote published on the Mises.org website. And for those of you that want to find it, if you find it, email it and tell and ask if it's me. And if you get it right, maybe I'll tell you. But, similar thing happened with Seven Son and myself, although we didn't come together until a year and a half or so later. But when feminism started making its way in and something called mutualism, which maybe Swedish listeners are not familiar with, left libertarianism, it's sort of what I would say, the best way to sum it up is the cultural Marxist infiltration of libertarianism.
Right. Yeah.
So taking, because really libertarianism is kind of an American thing. It's kind of like this, we're American patriots. We love the Constitution. We love guns. We love capitalism. And I can get down with all of that. And it was kind of a white American identity thing. And I think it's all, if you go most libertarian, it's all white American guys that love guns and love capitalism. And I'm totally fine with all of that. I really actually like that. And, but then also all these college girls started getting involved and all these progressive causes, and they were finding a way. They're like, the real free market is only when there's actually no market at all and everybody gets everything equally. And I'm like, somehow you've managed to – libertarianism, which is like a direct reaction to Marxism. Like most of the theories of it were promulgated by Ludwig von Mises, who was doing it literally as a direct reaction to Marxism. He was trying to create something that was a bulwark against Marxism.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. He didn't, there is no bulwark against Marxism. Marxism can leech its tenderly claws in there no matter what. And it did. And so I started getting fed up with it. And so one of the things we were talking about earlier was like how to explicitly make it so the left cannot infiltrate and undermine what you're doing. And Neo-Reaction was working on that. That was a problem that they were working on. And I always think of neo-reactionaries as kind of like guys that were libertarians or anarcho-capitalists that discovered the race issue, figured out that, you know, libertarianism in and of itself doesn't have enough intellectual foundation to fight off the more sophisticated attacks by the left. So that's sort of where it all, that's the direction we all started going in. And then I would say it's only been a little while now when I realized that, it's been about a year or so, but the demographic issue really started hitting me square in the face, where that's really now I'm at the point where that's my main focus. And I think that the site has moved in that direction. But we still have a little bit of a libertarian-ish feel, kind of like an Anglo-American kind of free market, laissez-faire feel to it, but we're definitely going in the direction of white nationalism, for lack of a better term, in terms of we feel that our country is being overrun. It has been being overrun for many years, but we're going to become a minority, and the country that our ancestors built is going to go away.
Mike, do you think that, as you say, the site moves more white nationalists, do you think, I mean, I know you're not going to, I'm not going to give up the economics viewpoints we have on libertarianism. The question becomes, I think someone asked this in our group, would you be willing to, would you just take the economics and make them a second priority?
Yeah, I've done that. I've moved it. I do still think that as laissez-faire as you can get is the best policy, but of course you can't be laissez-faire in everything. The government has to protect property. It has to protect the borders. It has to have a military. So, you know, those are all heretical positions from certain libertarian camps. And I have friends. You know, you guys had Greg Johnson on your show, and I've become very good friends with Greg. I had lunch with him over the weekend, and we actually had intended to have, you know, like a 90-minute lunch. We ended up having like a 4 or 5 hour lunch because that's how much we kept just talking. There are a few other people there. And, you know, those guys are more sort of, I have actually come to look at, for about lack of a better term, fascist economics.
Right. Yep.
And there's actually quite a lot to work with there. There's quite a lot of compromise between a capitalist position and a fascist position. Fascists, as far as I can tell, are pro-individual rights. They're pro-market. They're not for, you know, this complete communism state control. Like, they're state control, but it's not at the level that communism tries to do, and they're not trying to create equality for everyone. They're trying to create a functioning system, essentially. So I'm actually okay with that. That's fine. I mean, it's not so. It's like when I talk to Greg, he's a little bit more left on economics than I am, and I'm always like, you know, well, it doesn't matter because I don't ever expect that. Say we ever achieve the white ethno state, I don't expect that there won't be.
You do.
That there won't be laissez-faire and socialists in that country. So when we achieve that goal, I will be on the laissez-faire side. Greg can be on the lefty side. But we won't hate each other. We won't be enemies.
Right.
Right.
That's an interesting point, though, because I've actually been trying to understand the economics of fascism, if you will, for some time, because some people obviously are connected with corporatism, and I always wondered what level of or which direction it goes, rather, because obviously it seems now that under these so-called, we know that it's not free market in the U.S. There's a lot of corporations, of course, that have a lot of influence, lobbying, etc. But it's a scenario of where you have either you have the government running the businesses or the businesses running the government, right? It's like which one is the best? And I think, well, which is the one that makes sure that the interests of the people is fulfilled, right? Nomenclature to the side.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that comes to the fore. It's interesting. I actually, today, one of my favorite economists when I was a libertarian was Hans Hermann Hoppe, who was a German anarcho-capitalist libertarian for the Mises Institute. And I I don't know if I actually liked him as an economist or as a philosopher, or just a general guy that says really edgy stuff. But so I was listening to a lecture he had today where he did a lecture on the economic doctrine of fascism. And I found myself, when I was a libertarian, like 8 years ago, I'd been like, oh, these fascists, socialists, you know. But as I was listening, I was like, you know, he's quoting it, and he was actually doing a very good job of not judging and inserting his own point of view. He just wanted to inform, and I was like, you know, I actually find myself agreeing with, like, 80% of this. You know, like 80% of this doctrine I completely am okay with. And it was funny because he was actually, of course, he was being edgy and kind of maybe trolling a little bit. He's like, let's compare Franklin Roosevelt and Hitler.
Right.
From yeah. just a purely economic perspective. And he's like, and libertarians are actually going to have a lot more to agree with and admire about Hitler's economic policy than FDR's. And Hitler's was much more successful. He was successful in the first 7 years. You know, and like, he achieved a lot. He got rid of unemployment. He did a few very good things very early, which I, as a free market kind of guy, can get behind, which is he didn't bail out bad investments. He didn't bail out the banks. He didn't bail out rich people whose, investments were sunk in all this capital that was depreciating. He let them just go, which is what both actually in the U.S., both conservatives and libertarians were saying should happen after the 2008 crash. So he did that. He cut taxes. No, we did. We shouldn't have. And he cut taxes and he crushed the unions. Now, granted, he crushed the unions because they were infested with Jewish communists, but still. You know.
Yeah.
So he made a lot of good moves. So it's sort of like, as I was listening to this speech, I was like, yeah, you know, economically, I can get behind this doctrine for the most part. And it doesn't, you know, but it's just become less of an issue. There's not going to be a free market utopia. It's never going to happen. We're going to have a state, and the state should protect the interests of the people. And the people should be defined as an ethnic in-group, because if it's not, then you just have competing ethnicities trying to rent seek from each other, and really what that ends up being is minorities are not going to be minorities anymore, but non-Europeans rent seeking from Europeans, because we're the productive ones.
What does that mean, by the way? Sorry, but my English is lacking in certain areas. Rent seeking, what does that mean?
Rent seeking is sort of the dichotomy between rent seeking and libertarians have this idea, like, there's the legitimate way, there's the economic means of gaining wealth, and there's the political means. So rent-seeking is using politics to get wealth.
Like
using the government, lobbying, using social justice, using white guilt. Yeah, you know, people that, like, feminists, essentially. The entire feminist movement is supported by subsidy. There's no market for feminism. They have to be supported by government handouts, whether at the university level or, you know, threats of lawsuits. So someone has to get a job, and every corporation has to make a niche job for, like, a diversity coordinator or something like that. That's rent seeking.
Right.
Kickstarter projects for YouTube videos about video games.
I'm sure Sweden is more than familiar with this type of thing.
Well, exactly. I was just going to say that. That's what we have.
Having to make room for a feminist in every department.
Exactly. Well, yeah, well, if we are on the topic of kind of libertarianism and whatnot and how that has, or the free market system, or the so-called free market system, I guess we should say, in the U.S., what's the relationship to multiculturalism there? A lot of people have argued that, well, that's the very factor in some cases that drives, immigration and, dumping the wages and get a lot of other people in for the purposes of cheap labor. It's kind of as I've heard it anyway, some people have said that they have an attitude that, well, money is smarter than people, so let just the money decide, and then we'll adjust accordingly, right?
Do you want to handle this one, Seventh Son? I can say my piece, but
There needs to be more. I mean, free market libertarians, they don't put anything ahead of what you just said. The money will... Money will be smarter than people, but money doesn't have any loyalty. Money doesn't have any blood. Money doesn't have any soil. So how we run into the problems where we've sent manufacturing overseas to a certain extent, and we're allowing the allowing ourselves to be overrun from the southern border and putting downward pressure on wages for entry-level jobs, jobs where you have to work with your hands, stuff like I do. You know, a lot of my work is I'm stealing jobs back from the immigrants at this point, doing a lot of painting and you know, just contract work. And it's just I don't like the money talks, money smart. It's not enough. I mean, how are you supposed to have a national identity when that's all it is? I mean, there's more important things. Like, you can, you know, lettuce. How much would lettuce cost if it wasn't being picked by southern immigrants? I don't know what would happen to it, but what is the regulatory institution and what is all the red tape that made it more economical to have them come do that than to have us, our own people, do it? What has all been put in place that makes having your television built in wherever and imported back over here from China? Why is that shipping cost lower than a decent wage here? Or not even a decent, just any wage. How did that happen, and how can we unravel that? And what was the other example? Oh, now you have the Japanese car companies. This is my favorite manufacturing story. It's like, okay, at some point the Japanese were able to compete with us in our powerhouse industry in building automobiles. You know, America's Detroit. We build cars, and suddenly Japanese imports are coming in. And now Detroit is so unionized and so tied up in all these rules and that now the Japanese companies are coming over here and they're building the factories in the American South. But the union culture hasn't taken over the place yet, and they're able to compete with us on our own soil.
Wow.
Detroit
is a crater.
That's what's wrong with that, though? Like, they're creating jobs. They're building heavy industry here, and they're giving people jobs. It's freaking Detroit and the UAW's fault that they have created so the South is competitive. And the South needs that capital investment, so I don't have any problem with that.
No, I'm not saying I have a problem with Japanese doing this.
They're a friendly government. It's fine.
It's a hilarious outcome for what they did to Detroit here, for what our government, UAW, allowed to happen up there. This is a hilarious comeuppance for them to have the Japs build plants here. It's great. It's poetic.
Well, you figure there is a shipping cost, right? So if they're not being weighed down by the UAW, and they have a huge market for their cars in the United States, it's cheaper to make them here than to ship them across the Pacific. It's definitely cheaper. So build them here, sell them here. And, you know, you don't have to deal with all the crap up in Detroit. You can hire Southern people who are more than happy to work in the factories. And, you know, they make pretty good money. I mean, they're making like $60,000 a year average. So, you know.
But it is American workers at these manufacturing plants. Yeah, okay. Well, that's good. We had in Sweden, we had a, you know, kind of like a Chinese project for a while. I think it ultimately failed, but there's been a couple of attempts where they were basically to build a whole town, basically, in like more central northern Sweden and basically bring over all the Chinese that were meant to work and everything there as well. This is like the idea of the nation has obviously gone out the window, and these companies are doing whatever they want. And as you said, what is the priority here? Is it cheap lettuce, or is it the future of our people that should be the priority? You know,
I think I'm focused on my focus is the future of our people, but I do want to throw a little bit of a wrench into that narrative because I don't entirely agree with it. I think, I mean, if, first of all, for auto factories in the U.S., you better have they're not hiring people that don't have work authorization in the U.S. And that's actually not something that most of our problem is from illegal immigrants. Legal immigration, I don't like some of the things that they do, but proportionate to illegal immigration, it's not much. Now they don't have any. We've gotten rid of any racially or European centric immigration policy. That's true, but the number of legal immigrants compared to the number of illegal is minuscule. And they generally have to go through all kinds of hoops. So if we actually just enforced the law, we'd be in a much better situation than we are. And I also question how much there is this idea that it's the big corporations want to do it to drive down the cost of labor. I question that because big corporations don't hire illegal labor. They're still subject to all the labor regulations. And every time I've ever applied for a job, I have to prove I'm a U.S. citizen with permission to work in the country. And they actually are very careful about that. And when they talk to people from Hispanic countries, South American countries that want a visitor's visa to come to the U.S., they're very careful about whether or not those people are going to go back. So it's the people that are coming in are the people that can filter across the big southern border illegally and get under the table work. Usually it's not for big companies. Usually it's day labor. You know, you ever go to a Home Depot in Arizona? You'll have a parking lot full of illegals. And that's what they're doing. And I know Seven Sun, they're competing with you, but that's because
I'm saying you can go to the Home Depot right around the corner.
Yeah, you can go to Home Depot by your house. And I know you have competitors that do the same business as you that will hire these guys, and because they're just, what are they doing? They're doing roofing and, you know, tiling and siding and stuff like that. You know, they're doing stuff around, they're doing dad core around the house. So, like, you know, that in that situation, yeah, those contractors, and in that situation, I'm on your side because you're doing everything right. You're running your business above board. We talked about this before a little bit.
Yeah.
You're running your business above board. You're paying insurance. You're paying taxes. You know, you're paying your workers according to the labor laws.
Right.
Some of the competitors aren't doing that. They're just bringing in Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But it's not really the big corporations that are doing it. That's the part of the narrative that I think is mistaken. And I also think that it's not really the quote-unquote free market system's fault, because why is it that one reason generally is just we're so much wealthier and our countries are much nicer, right? So they want to come here. And
yeah, people have money to spend on lawn mowing that these people have like never seen all in one place before.
Yeah.
They're going to get
here. I can throw this guy $10 to mow my lawn, and that's like a week's freaking wage for him. So it's like there's incentives for them to come that are separate. And the thing is, we've created so much wealth in this country from a generally capitalistic laissez-faire system that it's like this irresistible place for them to come to. And I think that if there's a few things that we don't need to do that are outside of the market system, like we don't need to actually, many states now give them welfare benefits. And we even have a friend who works in social services in California. And he's like, not only do we give them benefits, we're not even allowed to check their status. Although it's federal law for state welfare agencies to check the immigration statuses of their clients, they don't. And they don't because the majority of their clients are not legally in this country. In New York City, I have family members in New York City that work in the social services bureaucracy. Primarily, their clients are, well, there's the black population, which is its own problem, and then there are illegal immigrants. And they call them undocumented workers, but they still make damn sure they get every dime that the city will give to you. And
right.
It's not citizens that are doing it. And so this creates a whole other incentive other than just, you know, the biggest recipients of welfare in the United States are families with a mother and a wife, of husband and wife, with one low-income worker and multiple children, and that just spells out Latino immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it's not just that the corporations want to bring them here to lower wages. I mean, that might be part of it somewhere, but there's a lot of other incentives going on. And I think if the government was just like, look, these people are breaking the law, we're going to send them back to their own country when we catch them, and companies that hire them are going to get in trouble, and we're not going to give them welfare benefits, and we're going to refuse them medical services because they're not citizens. If we did that, they would be gone.
Right.
Education. That's the next one. We refuse them access to public education.
Oh, yeah. They fill up our freaking schools.
I mean,
sorry. Now I'm starting to get it. Now I'm starting to get triggered.
This is what we do. We trigger warning. In the city where I work a lot, I mean, they had to build an entire new middle school to account. I mean, it's not a bunch of... It's not thousands of white faces packing the new middle school.
Right. Yeah.
What happens is the white parents, they don't want to send their kids into that environment. They send their kids to private school. But they're still paying property taxes to pay for the public school, which is filled with freaking immigrants.
Well, let me tell you, let me go one further, Goy. I didn't want to stay in that town and buy a home because the taxes were going to be so much higher. I would be involved with that school district. So I moved, you know, up where I am, where you've been, where the taxes are lower and
The school's gooder.
So we should just tell the Swedish audience, or just the, wherever people are in the world, there's a little bit of a code that middle class, other middle class, so to speak, white people in the U.S. use with each other to inform each other whether a neighborhood is white enough or not.
You have good schools. Good schools.
Yeah, exactly.
Good schools means this is a white neighborhood. You can have kids here.
Well, that's a good point, because I mean, I've listened to you guys and you talk a lot about obviously signaling to each other and different things, because it's all about not what you say but actually what you do. We have actually, there was a recent study even in Sweden too that points in the same direction, where basically, despite that everyone is seemingly on the surface happy about the chaotic multiculturalism we're getting and so-called diversity, then their actions points to a different direction. Recent studies show that most, you know, Swedes actually move away. They move into where there are other Swedes. So we have Swedish flight, white flight in Sweden as well. And that's what it's about, right? It's about what people actually want, and that's where people should look to get the truth.
Yeah, I mean, and even in the U.S., where it's like basically a professional death sentence to say anything racist, and I'm sure the same is true in Sweden, from what I understand.
Oh yeah,
that and maybe even more so. Maybe even more so.
I think so. It's
still
weird.
We have a little bit of a right-wing culture here,
right?
You know, a subculture, although it's one that generally I think Europeans frown on, the kind of America and guns and hamburgers, you know, which I've got, I confess, some affection for, but, you know, I get why it's maybe
not so awesome.
Yeah, burgers are freaking great and guns are awesome. So.
I don't see a problem with that whatsoever. Now, it seems that in America, it's definitely more, people get fired quick. I guess it's evident of the union culture that exists in Sweden, because you can say these things in Sweden and you'll end up, you literally get, like, what they say, hanged in the press, hanged in the media, right? You get, they lynch you in the media, that's the word. And but the chances of you getting fired are still fairly low. That takes a while, you know, because of the unions, and they have the employer by the balls, basically. But in America, it seems like you get fired immediately whenever you say something. You're out on the street, that's it.
Yeah, I mean,
there is a union. Saying something racist, you're now disqualified from any protection from anything, because you're just a horrible, horrible person, and you should act, really, what they would like is to actually literally lynch you.
The funny thing about that is that
yeah.
In the U.S., the strongest union by far is the teachers' union. And
right,
we just had this incident where two people in the teachers' union who spoke out on this issue we had, maybe you saw the video of this pool party and the cops were busting up the black kids at the pool party.
Yeah.
So one guy, who was a principal of the school, simply said, "I support the police." That's all he said. And he said it in a Facebook comment. And it's the summer. He's not even on the job. And he got fired. Another woman actually said that she wanted to go back to segregation, which I was like, okay, now, as much as I agree with you, you should have known better if you're a teacher. But, you know, the teachers union, they're okay, get rid of them, because the teachers union is run by progressives.
Right.
So any deviation from progressive ideology, they're not going to stick up for their workers. So, I've been a white collar worker my whole life, so it's just at will employment. Like, the employer, either both I and the employer have equal ability to sever that relationship for any reason at any time. And but, you know, this is one of the things that's moved me away from this whole sort of absolutist libertarian stance to more like, because it's weird how the absolutist libertarian stance, when it comes to a relationship between an employee and an employer, now gets you into this place where, oh, you said something racist, you're fired, because you have no recourse. And it's like, free speech is it's a culture as well as just a legal thing. So the government's never going to. The last thing I'm worried about is the government right now in terms of punishing me for my speech. I'm much more worried about professional pitfalls. So I don't think that the state actually, there is actually a pretty robust set of protections where the government won't punish you for saying something. But everybody else will. And that's worse in some ways.
Right. Son, you wanted to add something there to that?
I just was throwing out there that, like, the exemption to the First Amendment in America is just growing into a wide chasm, the exemption of hate speech.
Oh, yeah.
Anything that you say that sounds mean, that the liberals and the progressives don't have a good counter-argument to, that makes them feel extra bad, can be called hate speech. And since they own just about everything, I mean, just like our friend Meraki, who just had another... He just had a video pulled from his YouTube channel. YouTube cited hate speech as the reason. It was a parody song. I think it was Oven Man got pulled down.
Oh, that got pulled down?
Right. Got pulled. He posted a screen cap of the notification he got from YouTube, and it's like,
his latest song is definitely going to get pulled.
Well, I mean, everything he's got has the potential to be pulled because there's jokes in there that it's not meant for them. The jokes are meant for us. I mean, this is the reason why there's no Daily Show, there's no The Right Stuff that Biz YouTube account, because it would be
right
immediately. And it's just so funny that, you know, that's exactly what I brought up before when I was thinking of the teachers union and that principal who said, "I support the police." It's not even...
Who would have ever thought that you couldn't say you support the police?
Exactly.
You support law enforcement. It's like the most pro-social thing you can say. I mean,
that's enough to make you exempt from union protections, from just being shit-canned from your job. That's all it took. He didn't drop any N-bombs. He didn't say it. He didn't say anything about them darkies got what they deserved in that front of that pool. Nothing like that. Just, "I support the police." That's it.
The funny thing is, that guy was a principal of like a 99% black school, so they might have done him a favor, but still.
Now, in the 60s, they stressed the importance of free speech and to, you know, allowing to the, you know, whatever they wanted to do, basically to, you know, to for their ideas to get through and all of that. But it's turned into such a harsh, tyrannical environment now, and they've managed to somehow also clamp down, as you guys are talking about here, on free speech. Where, but we have to understand, though, that this is, I mean, they don't care about free speech at the end of it. All of this has been a mechanism to gain control politically, and they will do whatever they have to do to gain control, right?
Yeah, and the frustrating thing is that it's like, as I said before, there's substantive free speech and there's, like, technical free speech. Like, in the U.S., technically we have free speech because the state isn't going to do anything to us because everybody else will, because everybody else has been so... you know, indoctrinated with this progressive view, or if they don't, they know that they better shut up. And if you have somebody who's financially secure in the U.S., they can say whatever they want, and that's great. But those of us who aren't, if not financially insecure, who still depend on an income from employment, you're not going to stick your neck out there unless it's under a false name, because it's just not—it's not worth it. And so we don't have a culture of free speech. We don't have a culture of open debate. The culture is, and it's interesting because the very people that claim they were so freaking oppressed, and this is the thing. This is one of the things that the sort of the right, or at least the American right, has always done, is that because of dedication to constitutional principles, you let the left say whatever they wanted in the 60s. And now they're in control, and they have no such principles.
No.
No such principles.
Yeah. Well, it's really disheartening, you know, and it's, I think, one of the mechanisms, just to kind of return to, I guess, one of the main themes that you guys have running throughout your shows is the aspect of just making fun of these people and using humor to start to, make things a little bit less serious, because obviously these words and these labels and the things that they toss at anyone who speaks about these matters who are not abiding to political correctness, it's all become so extremely serious. And what's strange about it, though, is that, I mean, now they're literally encroaching into humor as well, as you guys said. For some reason, I've noticed that they're very adamant about taking down songs for some reason, maybe because they're catchy or something, so people will sing along, while certain other more academic videos, still at least, is actually up and available on YouTube, despite that the topic might be deemed offensive. But how important do you guys think humor is in all of this, of basically, you know, disarming all their arguments that they have and trying to kind of chip away at this mountain that we have in front of us right now?
It's so important. What we set out to do was try to, we're trying to establish kind of like a hip counterculture to it. And you can't do that without having humor and without having, I think, the vibe that we have in The Daily Show of being kind of like a bunch of bros hanging out. But, oh, they're going to talk race realism and they're going to bring some nice autistic statistics with it. And it's going to be very informative while it's being fun and silly at the same time. I think it's really important because I don't think there was anything else out there alt-right that had the tone that we're bringing to it. I think I hope that that's what we're achieving, and yeah. That's really what we set out to do. And I think it's very important that it can be, because I think I remember in the aughts being like very W conservative, very Bush conservative, and just being triggered all the time by entertainment. This movie, this sitcom, and it was always like, why are you right-wingers complaining about left-wing comedy? Why aren't there any funny right-wingers? It's like, I don't know why there aren't any funny right-wingers. I mean, I think I'm so trying to do that some. Trying to answer that, I guess, a bit. And it was very frustrating to not have, you know, nobody was funny. I guess you could say Limbaugh's funny, but...
Well, that's so bizarre, isn't it, though? Because, I mean, everything they do right now, it's like, it's ripe for the picking. I'm watching some of the movies and stuff, and it's like, oh, my God. I mean, liberals are just an easy target right now.
The transracialism is like, it's a meme that we made up, and now they're doing it. I don't mean we. Like, alt-right was laughing about trans-negrophobia, like, months ago, and now it's like an actual, it's happening.
Yeah, I mean, we were saying, like, can we extend this idea of you can identify as whatever to race and trolling with that, saying and we would troll them by saying, like, okay, so a man wants to become a woman, and when he becomes a woman, he dresses himself up as the most sort of stereotypical, like he puts on, you know, like the way Bruce Jenner or whatever Caitlyn dressed himself, like become not just becoming a woman, become like a very pretty sort of almost whore looking woman. But like, so let's say I'm white and I decide, oh no, I'm really black, and then I start doing like an Uncle Ruckus impression, or I start shucking and jiving, you know. It's like, would you be offended by that? And it's like, now they can't even, the thing of the left is so goddamn serious about everything. Like, they take themselves so freaking seriously, they've lost the ability to laugh about anything. Because being funny means you're hitting something that could potentially be a trigger in somebody somewhere. Because humor is laughing at people. Because if it's not laughing at people, then what are you laughing at? Even if it's good-natured or it's not good-natured, depending, it doesn't matter. You can do both. But you're laughing at people. That's what's funny. People are what's funny. Nature isn't particularly funny. It's people. And the left is so freaking sensitive on every little thing. They can't laugh at themselves. They can't laugh at other people. They can't laugh at anything. So we can destroy them by laughing at them.
Yep.
The only liberal humor that's left is really tired, old, you know, Comedy Central, Jon Stewart stuff where he's like, ugh, look at the stupid 60-year-old white Christian. They're dumb. And it's getting so old. It's been doing this shtick for, what, 10 years? Well, he like edits a video of a Republican congressman to make them sound stupid. It's like, great job, bro.
It's always the same. You know, we're looking at some of the Hollywood movies. We've done a couple of reviews of, like, Anchorman 2, you know, things like this. And it's like, it's so predictable. You can, every time, it's the same formula. They bash the same people. It's always, you know, the fat, stupid, white American male, you know, and it's like, it never changes. They never get anywhere with it.
Yeah, and I think it's old now. I mean, I didn't even try to watch Anchorman 2, but I mean, you know, I mean, there's still some funniness out there. I mean, liberal people still produce funny things, but they're not funny when they're political.
And that's what they're all the time almost these days.
Yeah, now they're increasingly becoming political all the time. And I think that George Bush being president for 8 years, while the intelligentsia in the United States and the media was dominated by the left, the fact that during those years, what was left of white America still had the electoral power to put him in power. No, I'm not defending him. I think there was a lot of things bad about George Bush. More bad than good, but it was a very triggering time for the left in terms of the intellectuals and the media class, and that's owned by the left. There's very few points where there's any conservative or right-wing entryism into that area. And so for like 8 years, they were like constantly raging, and now they're in power, and they've just gone totally overboard.
Yeah.
And they have no sense of proportion. They have, you know, and they've convinced themselves that white males, white Christian males, are like some sort of devil figure.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely.
They have, you know, no sense of proportion at all.
Well, guys, let's take a break here just in a minute or two, and then we'll pick up in the second hour much more to ask you about, both about the show and all the other, you know, craziness that's going on here. But let's just give out some of the website and whatnot. You have, obviously, a couple of sites out there where people can follow the radio show. You have a couple of different, I think, kind of segments that you have featured on your SoundCloud page and whatnot. And please let us know if there's any, I guess, personal pages you'd like to give out for people who get in touch with you guys or whatever. So whoever want to start on that, please go ahead.
Well, there's the rightstuff.biz is the blog. We have... There's a category there. There's a link for the daily show. That's the podcast. And we also do all accessible on the SoundCloud account, which is, what is it, soundcloud.com, the right stuff one.
I think it's the right stuff one, all dash separated. But there's also, you can get to it from any of the daily show links on our main website. To get in touch with us, there's a contact link on the website, but that just goes to our email, therightstuffbiz@gmail.com. We also, we recently launched Ovenworthy, which is a parody of Upworthy. So check out Ovenworthy. And the point of Ovenworthy, and there's going to be no on Ovenworthy, and I will edit to make sure that none of the people that are contributing to it break any of the rules. There's going to be no N-word. There's going to be very few instances of profanity. And it's going to be very sarcastic, such that it's shareable on maybe a Twitter or a Facebook. So if you got a Twitter, follow us and maybe retweet some of our stuff. Retweeting is like a little bit safer. Like if sometimes you put something on Facebook, your family sees, or like your blue-pilled, your liberal friends see. And if it's too far, then you get into a big heated discussion and they'll block you or whatever. But these are very sarcastically worded in such a way that you can get away with sharing it here and there. So, and if you've also just got a Twitter that speaks to the right, you're just some good parody site for people to go and laugh at.
The great thing about it is we've already had a liberal site fall for it.
Oh, yes, we did.
It was some gay website that picked up
Gay Star
the other.
News shared one of our posts.
There
said,
you go.
The funny thing, they're like, posted on Ovenworthy, they said this, and it was like our total sarcastic mocking of liberal language, and they couldn't, you know,
couldn't figure it out.
We passed the Turing test. So.
Exactly, that's funny. Well, I mean, it's so absurd that people are literally living in different worlds, and what's humor to one person is, you know, absolutely the good stuff to another. You know, it's so bizarre. But
like I said, what humor to one is actual narrative to somebody in this case.
Yeah,
exactly.
We hit it. Whoever wrote that text nailed it so good that they couldn't tell that they weren't just advocates.
Exactly. All right, guys, we'll take a short break here. The websites again, ladies and gentlemen, therightstuff.biz and ovenworthy.com. There's some funny things on there. I definitely hope you check it out and get offended in spades. But all right, nonetheless, we'll have the links up on redicecreations.com as well. Of course, you can click through there from there easily. But all right, guys, stay with us. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more.
I can't stop this feeling. Deep inside of me, girl, you just don't realize what you do to me. When you hold me in your arms so tight, you let me know everything's alright. What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
Miss these second hour as we continue at redicemembers.com, as we do with most of our guests. Take a look in our archives and check out some of the programs that we have for you. Over 1,000 now on a lot of different topics. Sign up for a membership and get full access. You can stream or download or add the podcast feed to a podcast app on your mobile device, and you can get all the shows in that way if you prefer. We have much more to talk about with Mike and Seventh Son. In the second hour, we'll get into some of the heated, oven-worthy topics they have presented in order to instigate the tipping of sacred cows across the mainstream and the alternative board. But yeah, tune in to find out what's coming up in the second hour. Some funny stuff, bizarre and frightening all at once. If we don't make fun of it, though, sanity will be challenged. And making fun of it all is something that these guys do very well. All right, we'll be back after the break. Thank you for listening. We'll see you on the other side.